and there will be a separate meeting convened here later in the morning that with on the agenda that's posted for 8 a.m. There are two work session bills that are listed here, House Bills 3241 and 2909, that were rolled over, and those will be rolled over again until Monday. So those bills will not be worked today. Otherwise, we'll be taking the agenda in the order in which it was posted. And I will begin by opening a public hearing on House Bill 2331.
House Bill 2331 increases court filing fees in civil matters earmarked for legal services, and it sets forth in the staff budget summary how they are, but that relates to the Dash 1 amendments, which have been superseded by the Dash 3 amendments. Yes, and what it does then, this is made applicable to filing fees after July 1, 2007, directs one half of the fees raised to go to pay court costs associated with the Court Facilities Planning Commission, creates a Court Facilities Planning Commission. Chair members of the committee, this bill will have to add a referral to Ways and Means Committee in this because it appropriates money and expends money.
Very good. Thank you, counsel. And we have Chief Justice Paul Dominguez in our hearing room this morning. Chief Justice.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, good morning. I want to begin by thanking this committee, individual members of the committee, for the courtesy that you have extended the office of Chief Justice during the session and the courtesy you've extended to me personally. I'm here to just offer very brief comments about House Bill 2331 and recommend its passage. The proposed amendments to House Bill 2331 do three things. They combine Senate Bill 733, which creates the Court Facilities Planning Commission, with House Bill 2857, which includes several existing funding mechanisms for court improvements. This eliminates the document recording fee and business registration fee revenue streams, creates a surcharge on court filing fees to fund a survey of court facilities, and increase on base filings to fund civil legal services for low-income people. It adds business members to the Court Facilities Planning Commission and directs the Department of Administrative Services to staff the commission and conduct the survey. I've spoken with each one of you individually about the serious nature of our court facilities. I've had the pleasure of working with Representative Krieger, with Senator Burdick, and other members of the legislature, with yourself, Chair. You know what a serious matter this is for the people of the state of Oregon. This bill has the ability to combine both access to justice for legal services and provide adequate and safe facilities for our citizens who have to enter those courthouses every day. I'm joined by Jerry Gatos from the Oregon State Bar. If you have any questions, be happy to answer them.
Very good. Thank you, Chief Justice. Mr. Gatos, do you have any remarks to offer?
Representative McPherson and members of the committee, the only thing I am here for is to support both the Chief Justice and this bill. The Oregon State Bar is totally behind it, has worked hard to get it to this place, and we really would appreciate the support. As you know, there's a 5% surcharge on all civil filings, which would fund the court facility study, but that would sunset in 2 years. So this is a good combination of ensuring both protection of access to the courts and ensuring that the court facilities will at least be surveyed and we'll have a ability to move forward with new construction. So Oregon State Bar is fully supportive, and thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gatos. Mr. Snyder, did you want to offer some remarks?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Paul Snyder, Association of Oregon Counties, and we also stand in strong support of this measure.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Krieger.
Now, I understand the court facilities part is for 1 year, those fees. Is it 2 years or 1 year?
Two.
And then it goes away after that's
right.
Done. And I would have liked to have seen the bill kind of clear and separate, and then we've added this other part, which becomes a permanent long-time increase for legal services. And we've had discussions regarding the dependency on how important legal services are to those people. I understand that, but I would have liked to have seen this separated because it clouds, it makes it harder for some people to come to the court facilities portion of the bill.
Any other comments or questions? Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's my understanding that the legal services fee has been a part of the structure, and this is a continuation, at least in part. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah, and actually, let me clarify that point. And is it the fee that is paid today, is it the same level that the surcharge puts it at, or did we drop down and we're restoring a level that it was at before? I'm a little fuzzy about that.
He went away and they're putting it back in. He went down.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, Susan Gravy on behalf of the Oregon State Bar, and I will try to answer this question. I don't have all the information, but what the attempt to do in this amendment to House Bill 2331 was to add an increase to the existing legal aid fee to make up for a lack of funding for legal services for low-income citizens in the state of Oregon, and that's a piece of House Bill 2331, the amendment to it.
Very good. Representative Kump.
I believe when we visited, when you came around and shared information, I apologize. How long has it been since this fee has been increased?
Chair McPherson, Representative Comp, I believe it was last increased 4 or so years ago.
Thank you.
No? No, 4 years ago.
Thank you.
Is the answer.
Thank you.
Just one comment is there's absolutely no doubt that we need to fund this court facilities study, get it done, and the work group and the Chief Justice and all those that supported him in that effort, I think, did an excellent job. It would be nice to have maybe some little more business representation on that. I see that's been corrected in the future, but at times we have to step up, and this is one of them.
Thank you, Chair. My only comment is when you come back after you meet, and the difficult part because of my involvement with working on long-range plans for facilities and schools, I hope you come with some alternatives, not just one or two ways to help get the funding, but we're going to have to look at a very creative, innovative way to be able to even begin the cycle of improvement, much less complete it, and what that long-range plan might be. And I've been on too many committees where we really identify the problem very well, but with little solutions. So that's the challenge.
We're going to have an escalated bar fee.
Yeah, I figured it out. Mr. Chair.
Representative Cameron.
Just maybe it would be helpful on the part of the bill with the legal aid fees, if you could explain the increases in the legal aid fees, how much that might yield, and how that money is expended in our state to help with the overall public safety judicial system.
Chairman Pearson, Representative Cameron, Susan Gravy again. I guess what I would do, first of all, is take a step back and make sure the committee is aware that there are ongoing discussions with the financial community, and this bill, the idea with this bill is that it will go to the Ways and Means Committee, and we will be massaging the numbers to make sure that we end up at the right place that serves everyone's interests the best. And so the fees that you have in front of you are subject to some massaging. It's not exactly the numbers I suspect we'll be moving forward with. And ultimately, to your question, how does that serve the community? We have some representatives here who could speak better to that question than I could, but access to justice is a key component in serving the citizens of the state, and we're only serving one-fifth of the people who come in the doors as it is, and it's an important part of the justice system and the things that we do.
Can you follow up with me? And I understand the financial details will be worked out in Ways and Means, but from a policy standpoint, it's important that I understand, maybe members of the committee, that I just need to understand the pool of money and how it is used, you know, so I can visualize the person walking in the door and what these types of services are helping to expedite and move things through our judicial system so people have access to a great system.
Representative Cameron, perhaps we can provide you with some more information to that effect. Would that be helpful to you?
Well, can you briefly just tell us?
How about Chair McPherson, Representative Cameron, I think it's best if we have Michael Mason address that question.
Okay, thank you.
Chair McPherson, members of the House Judiciary Committee, I'm here as president of Legal Aid Services of Oregon, the nonprofit law firm that serves low-income people throughout the state. And to your question, Representative Cameron, it's one of the differences I would just point out between the indigent defense system and legal aid is that we do not have offices in every county. We don't have the resources to have offices in every county. We serve regions of the state. Some of them have been very underserved, and a good example is Southern Oregon, where we had to close our Klamath Falls office 10 years ago, and I was actually on the board at that time, and we're reopening that on May 11th, thanks to a generous grant from the Oregon Law Foundation. But it costs, you know, for that office, which will serve Klamath and Lake counties, which have now, until recently, been served from Bend and Coos Bay, which, as you can imagine, doesn't work very well. That's $300,000 to run that office, two attorneys, a paralegal, and a secretary, which is very reasonable. We have the lowest, I'm not proud to say this, but we have the lowest salaries. I'm proud to say we're efficient, but we have the lowest salaries for attorneys in the state, an average of $41,000 a year.
Just for time's sake, I understand that, but I want to know who the user is. What do they look like? What kind of problem do they have that we're supplying the service so that they have access to our system? That's real important for me to know.
Thank you, Chair McPherson and Representative Cameron, to that question. Approximately 42% of our clients of legal aid are people who are victims of spouse abuse or battered persons, mostly women. Many are children who have been neglected or abused. That's about 42%. About another 8 or 9% are seniors who have gotten into various have run into various legal problems, and then the second highest percentage of our of folks we serve are people with what we call government benefits issues, whether that's with Social Security, disability, or the welfare system and that kind of thing.
Thank you.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to thank the group that's been working so hard on this. We did start out in the original 2857 with several different funding sources proposed and narrowed it down to what I believe is a good way to start this process, to at least get the commission going. I know there's a lot of work ahead. I used to do court tours and spent a lot of time taking students through the Multnomah County Courthouse, and I tell you that building, as well as many in this state, are in desperate need. And so I fully support this and applaud the efforts of the group that worked so hard to get us here. And I also wanted to just make sure that for Representative Cameron and I know Mr. Mason was talking about legal aid, the qualifications to qualify for legal aid are what, poverty level or with the income qualifications? Because it's for very low-income people in the
right.
state.
Chair McPherson and Representative Bonamici, it's approximately 185% of the federal poverty level, which by anybody's standards is still poverty. It's very low income.
Okay. Any further questions?
Thank you.
Then I'll excuse this panel. Those are all the all we had signed up on House Bill 2331.
No opposition.
There's no opposition. Is there anyone else who wants to present on House Bill 2331? Seeing no one, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2331 and open a work session on House Bill 2331.
Chair,
Representative Krieger.
I'd like to move the dash three amendments into House Bill 2331.
Representative Krieger moves the dash three amendments into House Bill 2331. Is there any discussion?
Objection.
And the dash three amendments are adopted? This bill needs to be referred
by prior reference?
Not by prior reference because it's different stuff, but it needs to go there because it appropriates money now.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 2331 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee.
Representative Krieger moves House Bill 2331 as amended with a due pass recommendation, I assume, and to be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Any discussion of that motion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Bonamici,
aye. Representative Cameron.
Yes.
Representative Forrest.
Aye.
Representative Kahn.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker?
Excuse.
Vice Chair Wilson?
Aye.
Chair
McPherson?
I'm sorry, did you call my name?
Yes.
Aye.
Busy day for him.
House Bill 2331 as amended moves from the committee with the due pass recommendation to the Committee on Ways and Means. I'll close the work session on House Bill 2331. And I'm told that 2327, there were some amendments being prepared on it that are not.
Chair, members of the committee, that there are amendments here. There's no one here to testify, and
I think what we'll do is open and close a public hearing, and so we've completed our public notice obligations in the role of our work session. So I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2327, and then I will close that public hearing, and we'll be rolling that over to our Monday agenda. We next have work sessions on several bills, and a couple of them will look familiar. And I'm going to open work sessions on House Bills 2847 and 3407 together.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you may remember the last time this was before us. After the meeting, I met with several participants, Kevin Neely, Paul Snyder, Tom Gallagher, Brian DeLashmetz, concerning this here in Pete Shepard. And we basically set out parameters for a set of amendments which are before you. And one of the things that we did on the amendments, and you may want to ask the participants to come up. Also, Craig Chisholm is here from Stuart Tidenlow in Portland. One of the things that I asked Jack Monroe to do was to run these amendments by Craig because he is a title lawyer, and one of the problems that you can always run into when you're touching deeds and mortgages is that it will upset the mortgage industry and the ability of title companies to insure it. I understand former back from email I sent the copy of the amendments to Jack and to Craig, and the email I get back is that they're comfortable with the amendments the way they are. One thing about the amendment that was not included, there was a decision made to amend 192.501 rather than 502, and 501 says that these documents are exempt, or these records are exempt, unless the public interest requires disclosure in a particular instance. We also went through, and let me go over to the appropriate page on page 14, which sets forth the bulk of what's in it.
Excuse me, Council, you're looking at it in dash one.
Dash one.
3407, and it looks like that did not manage to get into my bill folder. Thank you. Anyone else need a copy of the?
Sure.
Yes, okay. I see. Which dash amendment on?
Dash 407.
Dash 1.
We decided to use 3407 as the vehicle as it relates to this issue.
Yeah,
I'm sorry. Okay.
I don't have it.
2847, they're both similar. One dealt with police officers, the other one dealt with district attorneys. And it was the group's decision that it would focus on 3407 bill because it was a product of a work group.
And the dash what?
Dash one amendments.
All right. I got that. Got the dash one.
And going over to page 14, sections 30 and 31, if requested by a district attorney, a deputy district attorney, or an assistant attorney general designated by the attorney general, And you may remember Pete Shepard was in here discussing that particular aspect. And what we talked about is that the Attorney General has people who not only do criminal issues, but they also do dependency and domestic relations. And oftentimes, as we all know from what comes before us, people can get very angry in those areas. The home address and home telephone number of the attorney contained in the voter registration records for the attorney. The next one would be for public safety officers. The name public safety officer contained the county real property assessment and taxation records. This exemption applies only to the name of the public safety officer attorney and any other owner of the property in connection with a specific property identified by the office attorney and request for exemption from disclosure, et cetera. One thing that did not get in there, we discussed the ability of the people, the public officials, the office that would be redacting this information, that they would charge a fee. And we had planned to put that in the amendments. It did not get in there. What we had not finalized was the amount and who it should apply to. And what we did talk about and we agreed is that this was still a work in progress and that we would continue to work in this bill on the Senate side, given the lateness in session and the complexity of the issue. There are several parties here. I see Kevin Neely here, Paul Snyder, and Tom Gallagher, and Brian DeLashmitz, and they could add whatever the committee would like to hear further.
Mr. Chair, question of counsel.
Representative Flores.
And thank you, Counsel Taylor. Did you address, or is there addressed in the Dash 1 amendments the suggestion that was brought to us that former public safety officers, federal officers, and former federal officers would be included with this exemption?
Chair, members of the committee, Representative Flores, it was basically the feeling of the work group that was expanding the bill beyond where the consensus was. Doesn't mean it can't be added, but there was no consensus in the work group to go there. Yes. In the informal work group. You know, this is, as you can well imagine, that we're doing things on the on the fly right now.
Brian DeLashman, Reagan Council of Police Associations. In response to Representative Flores' question, there was a minor discussion about that. The Dash 2 amendments showed up today actually do that, but the problem is they amend the wrong sections. They would, in fact, accomplish what you were asking about, but the bill now amends 501. These amended 502. So in order to accomplish that, we would have to do that on the Senate side if you choose to move the bill out, and I would suggest you move the bill out today, and we'll work on that and have ongoing discussions about the fees as it crosses over.
Clarification.
Representative Flores.
And so, Mr. DeLashmit, the Dash 1s address the former...
No, Representative Flores. The Dash 1s clean up all the discussions that we had in committee yesterday about moving the entire section to 501 rather than 502. It clarifies the issue that I had, which was that some of the counties, in fact, were interpreting the language of exempting property and lien records from the disclosure as actually being the tax and assessment records. And so about half the counties were not blocking this information. I already have this statute, and so my portion of this was just to clean up to make sure that that assessment records, tax and assessment records, were in fact, they had the ability to block those. And then you have the DA's issue on top of that. But the Dash 1s do everything except for the one issue that the council indicated, which is the final discussion about the fees, and then the Dash 2s would have added the former officers, but they are, in fact, an amendment to the wrong section. They're to what we were working on before, which is the 502 section, a different section. So those are the two issues that would still be out there.
Representative Krieger.
Mr. Chair. Brian, what's the number that these prior and federal FBI, what's the number of those type of numbers of people that are going to have costs into this? Do you have any idea? Do we know?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger,
boy, I would really be speculating, you know, and I don't know. And there was, as I said, in the work group, there was a brief discussion yesterday about, you know, are we opening up the dam? You know, is there going to be a whole litany of folks that are going to come forward? Is this going to be a major cost? And that's kind of where we ended up with where we are now.
Legacy parole officers, prior parole officers, prior prison guards, prior security guy at a bank. I mean, where does it stop?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, that's why at the point we're at, the lateness of this body and the deliberation, we went with the base, which was, with the exception of adding the Attorney General's folks in, we went with cleaning up what I already had, which was public safety officers, adding the DAs, which was the other bill, and then just adding the Attorney General folks.
Yeah, mine's missing too. Oh, it's flipped around.
Chair, if I may, Paul Snyder, Association of Oregon Counties. Council Taylor has already alluded to the change with respect to Assistant Attorneys General. The way the amendment is phrased, I think, is fine. The Attorney General would designate to whom it should apply, but the basis for that has to do, the nexus would be, is there some anticipated risk to either the individual or the individual's family that would warrant the Attorney General designated these Assistant Attorneys General for that purpose. And with that change, we're fine on that issue.
Gentlemen, I'm trying to just track the mechanics of, and I see that there's a 501, and there's ORS 192-501. Mm-hmm. And
there's no 502 in the bill here.
Okay, and this, and we seem to have, there's a section 1 and a section 2 in these dash 1 amendments. And you might be, hey members, if your pages 7 and 8 might have been flipped over, at least mine was, so I had to kind of pull the staple apart in order to track what was going on. But, and just tracking where the bill stands currently, I see that under the subsection 31, we're dealing with voter registration records. And in 32, we're dealing with county real property assessment or taxation records. And I see different groups of people who are covered by each of those two sections, 31 and 32. In case of 31, it's a district attorney, deputy district attorney, assistant attorney general designated by the AG. And in 32, it's those individuals plus a public safety officer. So there's a difference between what happens on voter registration records and what happens on county assessment and taxation records. So can somebody help me understand that distinction?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Gallagher, representing the ONPA. I think the short answer is we've created a bit of a sausage here. On page 8 of the bill, you've taken what, as Brian DeLashmitz, fix to the bill that was passed last session that helps exempt other parts of the records for police officers. In section 2, you've added in the other requesters who want their names and addresses, and they have decided to exempt themselves from different pieces of the public record. So that's why, and if you look, one is amending subsection 25 or 26, and on page 14 you are adding new sections 30 and 31 to the public records exemptions. So
Mr. Chair and members, there's also, I think, another distinction between section 1 and section 2, and that is that section 1 amends ORS 192-501, and section 2 amends ORS 192-501 as amended by Section 3, Chapter 455, Oregon Laws 205. I think that's the one with the delayed effective date.
Mm-hmm.
So I think Legislative Council amends the same ORS section, but it amends it to include changes that are anticipated that are not yet effective but have become law.
Chair.
Representative Kahn.
I like the metaphor that this is a piece of sausage. I know that people have been working really hard, and I would be willing to know that this is the question I have. Is this going to be studied a little deeper and finessed a little better as it moves to the Senate if we move it today?
Yeah. Well, that's the question is really what are we passing on to our colleagues across the end of the other end of the building? We have a sort of a question about whether we want to we should move a product that's in this sort of evolving stage, but we also I think have some policy questions that would be helpful to send along as guidance, which are, we're the policymakers here. And so what I would like to have a sense of, and maybe the good use of our time here on this bill this morning, would be to get a sense about voter registration records as compared to assessment and taxation records, and so what public records should be the subject of these protections, and what individuals should be within the circle of protection, recognizing, as Representative Krieger had pointed out, there are going to be people who are going to be outside of that circle and who will make very plausible, persuasive arguments about why they ought to be inside the circle, and yet it keeps getting to be a larger and larger circle. So those are kind of the two policy choices. So let's focus on the first one to begin with, is what records should we be trying to provide protection or confidentiality for? And is there a reason why voter registration and property assessment and taxation records would be treated differently as to the groups of people? Yeah, ask that of
Mr. Chair, representing members of the committee. As you recall from my testimony yesterday, there was a pretty extensive work group, including the county clerks and the tax and assessment folks and public safety officers during the interim. We narrowed it to that. It was just a matter of, okay, are we going to have dog license applications? Are we going to have every record, everything that is in the possession of the county or the local jurisdiction fall underneath this? The examples that we had seen in which there was an abuse, somebody getting immediate information and abusing that, was in the tax and assessment area and the voter registration, and that's why we narrowed it to that particular piece, fully understanding that would be an enormous task for the county clerks and the county assessors to go through everything else that is possibly in their possession.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Gelassman has correctly characterized that discussion. I would simply add that the difference between the voter registration and the assessment and taxation redactions was purposeful. That on the voter registration side, the home address, telephone number, and I'm reading as I go. There was a little bit of a difference between the two records as to what was to be non-disclosed, and that was based upon a discussion of what information would be harmful to the officer if it were disclosed and what information is easily enough redactable in those two categories. So if you see some distinction, the distinction, I think, was on purpose.
Okay, but what I'm seeing, Mr. Schneider, is that a public safety officer who's not a DA or deputy DA or a DOJ lawyer, their voter registration home address and telephone number would be accessible, but not their real property assessment or taxation record. And that maybe there's a reason for that. Oh, it's a little hard for me to understand why
either one of them, you know where they are.
Right.
Because there's an address there.
Right. So it would seem to me we've got a question about whether there should be any different treatment as to who's protected with respect to voter registration records and as compared or distinguished from real property records.
Are you looking at page 7, Mr. Chair? The dash 3? The dash 1s, I mean? Is that where the difference is?
Well, it's on both on page 7 and page 14.
Thank you.
Because of that fact that there's a subsequent amendment to the same text. Mr. Neely, can you help us out?
Members of the committee, for the record, Kevin Neely, Oregon District Attorney's Association. Our intention was to essentially provide the exact same protections that law enforcement and to deputy district attorneys and district attorneys. Again, I'm not sure why it was drafted in the way it was. This is a bill that we just kind of moved everything into, obviously, at the last minute. I agree, based on what you've said in this committee so far, that it is odd that they don't include all of those people on line 19 of page 7. It seems like that ought to include the law enforcement language. The same goes for 14, page 14. If I understand what you're saying, why are only the DAs covered when it comes to the voter registration records? And I can tell you that I've also talked with the Secretary of State's office. They don't have a position on that. They already regularly X out the names in voter registration records when people request the voter file. So I don't think it would be again, as long as they get notice, that's a change that they make. It's not clear to me why law enforcement isn't in here.
Mr. Chair, this may relate to what happens now to 192.502. Keeping in mind that 502 already applies to public safety officers.
Now, Mr. Snyder, I need a reminder, or maybe it's not a reminder, I need to be educated on the differences between 501 and 502.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the differences between 501, the public body is required to apply a balancing test. The balancing test is established by a significant amount of case law as well as some specific definitions in the statute. Essentially, I'm not sure who mentioned it earlier, you have to test whether or not there's a public benefit to providing that information. The 502 protections have no such balancing test. They're essentially an absolute exclusion. Unless there's a balancing test that's written in 50, if you look at the 502 sub 1 and sub 2, there's actually a balancing test written into those. But once you get past those, there's no balancing test, and it's just an outright requirement that the public body redact the information.
So the effect of amending 501, as this bill does in its current form, is to put it in a balancing test environment so that they're and who exercises that balancing judgment?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that balancing test is first exercised by the public body, the custodian of the public records. So, for example, if I were to make a request to the Secretary of State's office and that request was for specific information about an individual, the Secretary of State's office would look at that. And if it was someone who was captured in the 501 exemption, they would then make an assessment about how important it was for the public to know that information. One of the classic cases relates specifically to law enforcement records. The law enforcement officer was engaged in some illegal activity related to he was a vice officer, and he happened to be running a vice ring out of his house in that case. And in that instance, the public body said, because that has a direct bearing on his public position, release the information. In that instance, it was about his personnel records. And so the balancing test was applied. The public body said, we have to weigh this in favor of releasing the information, even though it is protected, because it's so important the public needs to know. On the 502 side, that information could never have been released because there's no provision by which it can be. So if the public body deems that the information should not be released and the requester would like to have it released, they can then appeal that decision. If the request is made to a state body, that decision is appealed to the Attorney General's office. If it is made to a local body, then that decision is appealed to the district attorney. If it's made to an independently elected official, then it's directed straight to the circuit court. And that's the appeals process in the 501 provisions. Again, I think that there's also a similar appeals process in 502, but in those instances, the DA or the AG doesn't have to apply the balancing test. They just say, does it fit into the law? Does it fit into the exemption? If it fits into the exemption, we don't do it. If it doesn't fit in, then they give the information. Does that, long-winded clarity, does that help at all?
Okay, that's helpful.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to blame this on the early morning, but is this amending 502 as well as 501? Because I can't find a 502.
No, it's amending only 501.
Okay, so it's two places in 501. We're not amending 502 at all.
And, Mr. Chair, if I could, I suspect that that may be why you don't see law enforcement in here, and I think this might be where Mr. Snyder was headed. The exemption to law enforcement that keeps them out of the voter registration rolls, that's already in 502. You guys, the assembly passed that last session. And I noticed that they don't excise it out of 502 in the course of drafting these amendments. My guess is that the DA's exemption is going to be a 501 exemption as we're currently drafted, and the law enforcement exemption is in 502. Again, our intention is to mirror the two. It's my understanding, I don't want to speak for Mr. DeLashman, but he'll nod his head, I'm sure, behind me, that he was comfortable with again, aligning the two.
Mr. DeLashman.
The previous speaker is absolutely correct. I think the difference that we're seeing is that the voter piece was already in 502. You're mixing statutes, and all of our statutes were in 502 before. Now they've moved the tax records and assessments over to 501, but it appears that they didn't move what was previously in 502 for us on voter records out of that and put it in 501. And we have no problem with moving it over as it moves over to the other side, if that's a correction that helps people.
Okay. The only other input, since we have Craig Chisholm from the title industry, I would like to hear a perspective from that vantage point, just to make sure we're not disrupting the wheels of commerce here.
Craig Chisholm, attorney, but I'm representing Oregon Land Title Association. The key issue as far as title records is the deed records. In other words, the deeds, the grantor-grantee index that says Jones sold to Smith, and I don't believe that touches on this. In other words, if it obliterated the grantees and deeds, there would be a very severe problem. But I don't see that happening here. What I see is it relates to the tax account records. Now, in our business, we're concerned about taxes, but we know who has to be paid in those cases to remove that lien. We know it's the government that has to be paid. There's no question there. And if there's some question about a tax accountant working with somebody, they'll tell us. There can be some theoretical issues about removing names out of tax records, good and bad, but those are rather minor ones. The heart of our concern is that deed records are not touched. If there is a desire for secrecy in deeds, that can be accomplished as it is done right now by setting up blind trusts or having nominees and so on. That can be accomplished that way. But as long as the deed records are kept out of it, we're pretty safe in the title industry.
Okay. And I see that now. It wasn't really drawing the proper distinction, but this is assessment and taxation records and not deed records. Got it. Okay. Any questions for these witnesses? Thank you, gentlemen. Well, committee, because there's more work to be done in the bill, it was suggested to me by counsel that perhaps it ought to be rolled over to Monday. My preference would be not to do that.
I think that we're coming down to a deadline. It's not going to be easy to get things fully polished by Monday, and it may be the time for us to decide whether this is in good enough shape for us to move it on to its next portal in this process. That would be my inclination, but it raises a policy issue. Representative Cameron.
Mr. Chair, just this is an experience that I had, I think, last session on a bill that had to do with my fingers. And I think this is one of those pieces of policy that I think we need to move, and we're going to see if it's ends up being good policy. We obviously will see it back here with amendments on it. And at that time, we can decide to concur with it or not concur with it. And I think that this is something that will give protection. We got to help these people that put their lives on the line every day for us. And my preference is to move it out here and allow these gentlemen to continue to work on it on the Senate side and try to figure out some of those details.
Representative Krieger.
You can assign it to Jerry Crummell to carry, and they can write the floor speech, and we can ask the questions.
You're feeling mischievous this morning.
And, Mr. Chair, since Jerry Crummell's concern regarding the former federal public safety officers, federal officers, and former federal officers was not included in this discussion, that might not be a good idea.
It's Rep. Galizio's bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I've worked with all these people through the years. I know that we will continue to work in good faith, not only when we get in the Senate, but given the fact that we have a month to get it through the Senate, even before the bill gets there.
Good. I'll be glad to vote to move it as long as Mr. Snyder. I think, again, we all want to protect these people, and Mr. Snyder looks after the fee and be sure that we have the assessors and the county clerks. And I hope they'll look at adding former military spies to this list.
I thought the word was attaché.
I also will vote to move it along, but after just glancing at the two different statutes, I just hope that in the next Judiciary Committee, in some session soon, somebody fixes this whole morass, because it's really in need of it.
We'll be back here.
Well, it has been suggested, in fact, by some who thought that this process ought not be going forward this session, that there be an interim study to make more sense out of this. The question is whether we should pass this along, move this along through the process, and not just take no action in reliance on that happening, which could happen anyway. So, we are in work session on House Bill...
Mr. Chair, I'll move the dash ones to House Bill 3407.
Representative Cameron moves the dash one amendments into House Bill 3407. Is there any discussion? Any objection? And the dash one amendments are in the bill.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the House Bill 3407 as amended to the House floor with the do pass recommendation.
Representative Cameron moves House Bill 3407 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Yes.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Huff.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Excused.
Vice Chair Wisdom.
Aye.
Chairman Person.
Aye. House Bill 3407 as amended moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And Representative Cameron, we can offer Representative Galizio, unless you. But
if he doesn't want to carry it, I'll do that, Mr. Chair.
Okay, very good. Why don't we do that? Galizio, unless he declines, and that'll be Representative.
As long as I do it on a day that. Never mind.
Yeah. Very good. Well, I will close the work session on House Bill 3407 and the work session on House Bill 2847 and open a work session on House Bill 3420.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3420 is a bill that comes to you from Representative Barker. This bill was before us about a week ago. And this requires the Secretary of State to regularly audit all county juvenile departments. And you have the dash two amendments in front of you. And you will also see in front of you, I'd like to call up Phil Lemon, Steve Dole, and Chuck Hibner. What happened is after the last meeting, Mr. Hibner made a statement that they were planning to cover this with existing staff, with the reduced number of audits, and could do that. When I get back to the office, I had an email from Legislative Fiscal Office pointing out an AG's opinion stating that they were obliged by statute to charge for these audits. And so since that last meeting, we've been working on language that would amend that particular statute and allow them to do, as they said, to do it with current staff. We ran into some other difficulties concerning commingling of federal funds. So what you have before you is the dash two plus amendments, and I would ask the people at the witness table to go through these amendments if they could.
Chairman McPherson, committee members, Chuck Hibner, director of the Audits Division, and counsel ably described at the. What we were trying to achieve here, and as I stated in my prior testimony, we had contemplated doing audits. We had a focus for our audits. We had agreement on what it is we think we should be doing from the Audits Division point of view, and the amendments that are included in the bill, frankly, match up the language with where we had intended to go. And as I stated in my testimony, we felt and we were sure we were going to do this work with existing staff. As Legislative Fiscal Office rightfully pointed out, our law, or the law in the books, was if whoever we audit needs to pay the bill. And in the specific language in the bill was that we were going to be doing county audits. Now, we're going to be doing work in the counties, but the focus of the audit is going to be the system. So this helps match that up. And you'll see some subtle changes in the language, but from our point of view, they're significant. And that allows us to direct the audit as we had planned. It allows us to do exactly what we had said we were going to do it from our existing assessment dollars, and come back with a good product that gets into the counties and talks about their performance, but really is focused on the system and the overall governance and helping develop a system that is sustainable. As you see, the first change, do you want me to go through the specific changes?
Yes, no? Please.
Okay. If you go down to the first one, line 2A, where we're shortening that paragraph, ending it in audited, that really gets to our challenge on coming up with any sort of opinion as to effectiveness of criminal justice. Behavioral science, an auditor needs strong criteria, I think, as I stated last time, and there's no way we felt we could ever get to whether a program is effective from the point of view, from the higher level point of view. So we can get you a lot of audit information, but that whole, and we can do a lot of things around effectiveness, but that higher level behavioral science thing just isn't possible, and it just really helps us focus the audit work again. The next changes in that section one, again, we're trying to get to the county audit specific statements and gonna soften it enough to where it's the counties will be included, but what we're going to be doing is saying that they're subject to regular review, and that's what's going to be happening here. They're going to be the subject involved in as a subject in this review. And in C, again, it's getting the county audit language out, and we will perform an audit that includes an evaluation of county juvenile departments. Again, subtle change, but from an audit art point of view, it's significant. It allows us to do what we said we wanted to do. Adding E, I know that was something that the counties were concerned about, ensuring that they were not charged for the work. In my mind, the changes we're making to the bill get to that. This is a non-player, but if it adds, you know, some comfort, we're fine with E that says they will not be charged for the work. Next, section one. If you go to section two, again, it's putting some boundaries on the audits. It says we will do these audits, and we'll look at include no fewer than four counties, and that we'll do one in each biennium, and that we'll report back to the legislature in September of 2010 with the information on that. At that point, we'll sit down with all the interested parties and take a look at what really needs to happen. If there's more audits from the Secretary of State that needs to be done, that's fine. If the governance of the whole system is approaching a point where it's sustainable and you're getting the information you want and it's trusted and you can make the decision you need to make at that point, then maybe we'll take on our more normal role, which is to stand back and come in as needed or as we see we need to be needed. And that's kind of our hope in the long haul. We've talked with Mr. Dole about this. He was not able to stay long enough for this hearing. He had a prior appointment, but we've been hashing these through, and again, we're in agreement on these amendments.
Mr. Hibner, on just a quick scan, it looks to me as though all the changes that I see in the hand-engrossed version are in the Dash 2 amendments, except for the change I see on line 21 of page 1. And maybe I'm just missing it. The replacement of the word audited with subject to the review.
Chair McPherson, there's a couple other changes that are just similarly subtle. In line 23, you will note again the term Secretary of State shall audit the is stricken, and Secretary of State shall perform an audit that includes an evaluation of. So again, it's that subtle change in C.
But my point is that that change on lines 23 and 24 of page 1 of the printed bill, it does look to me as though, well, I guess the text is a little bit different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just a couple words. It's getting the county audit focus out and including the counties, but the audit will be of the system. of OIA in the system.
Council Taylor.
Mr. Hibner, are there any additional changes that are on the Handler's version that are not in the Dash 2?
Which are the Dash 2s?
If you could kindly go over those.
Mr. Chair, Council, Phil Lemon, Deputy Director of the Oregon Youth Authority. What you have here is the Dash 2s. The additions to the Dash 2s occur in the following places. On page 1, line 21, where the word audited is deleted and the phrase subject to regular review is inserted. That's one. The second change occurs, as Mr. Hibner just described, in lines 23 and 24, where we delete the term audit the and insert perform an audit that includes an evaluation of the performance of. The third change from the Dash 2s is in the handwritten material at the bottom of the page. The Secretary of State shall perform an audit that includes has been added. So again, they're very minor changes. They're intended to accommodate the concerns of the Secretary of State's office, but don't change the fundamental nature of the proposal.
I'm sorry, Mr. Lemon, the third change you just identified, where is that?
In the handwritten subsection 1 at the bottom of the page, Mr. Chair, the Secretary of State shall perform an audit that includes.
Page 2.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Audit that includes.
That's the same as the Dash 2s.
Okay. Any questions for these witnesses? I do. Council Taylor.
And what is the purpose of those particular changes, the three changes that you have mentioned on the record?
Members of the committee, Council Taylor, it is specifically so that we're moving from the focus and the potential having to bill counties for county audits to making it align better with what actually has been agreed upon needs to happen, a broader look that includes counties. But the focus is the system, so it's really aligning the language with what's been agreed really needs to happen and get away from the specific county audit provision.
So what I'm hearing is that given this additional language, there'll be no need for you to charge them.
Given the language, it does for this law. Okay,
for this law,
right. We would not need to charge them to do the work.
Thank you,
Mr. Snyder. Do you have something to offer?
Yeah, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties, and these hand and gross changes address one of the two concerns that we've had. Another may be implied or implicit, but I want to put it on the record, and that is that the Secretary of State may be auditing a system, but the flow of funds that are state funds are the focus. In other words, things that are funded by county funds, operated by county juvenile departments, would be an issue that would be beyond the scope of these audits. I just understood that from my discussions with Mr. Dole, and I just want to put that on the record.
Any further questions or discussion? Well, committee, we're in work session then on House Bill 3420. We have the Dash 2 amendments. We have several further revisions that are identified in the hand and gross version of the bill. Ordinarily, we would try to have more polished language before us before we move to bill. But we're getting down to the end. We'll have plenty of work to do on Monday as it is. And so I'm inclined to go ahead, because we have the text here actually before us, to go ahead and do a conceptual amendment for the variations from the Dash 2 amendments. Is the committee comfortable with that approach?
Move the Dash 2 plus amendments, the hand engrossed version, reflecting the Dash 2s and the conceptual amendments into House Bill 3420.
Representative Flores moves the Dash 2 amendments as conceptually amended by the hand engrossed version of before you, House Bill 3420. Any discussion of that motion? And I think maybe we should recite that it includes a suspension of our rules, which would ordinarily not permit a conceptual amendment.
and requesting a suspension of the rules to do so.
Very good. Any discussion of that motion? Any objection? Then the House Bill 3420 is amended by the Dash 2 amendments with the further conceptual amendments reflected in the hand-engrossed version before us. We now need a motion to, and we have a subsequent to Ways and Means on this bill. Which
Mr. Chairman, as a committee, one of the purposes of this amendment was to remove any fiscal impact, and we have a letter for you to ask the Speaker to remove the prior referral to Ways and Means Committee.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 3420 as amended and conceptually amended and pending the removal of the prior referral to Ways and Means to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Flores moves House Bill 3420 as amended, both by the Dash 2s and further conceptually amended, to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a request to the Speaker's office that the prior referral to Ways and Means be rescinded. Any discussion of that motion?
Can you repeat it?
We don't have all morning, Representative.
This is a test.
There's no discussion. The clerk call the roll.
Mr. Cameron?
Aye.
Mr. Dan
Cameron? Aye.
Mr. Dan Flores?
Aye.
Mr. Dan Krieger?
Aye.
Mr. Dan Reed?
Aye.
Mr. Chair Barker?
Excused.
Vice Chair
Whitman? Aye.
Aye. House Bill 3420 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation subject to rescission of the reference to referral of Ways and Means. And Representative Flores, would you carry that bill?
I would be happy to. My name is on the bill, unless Representative Barker would.
We could offer it to him if he'd like to, but otherwise, have you stepped into the breach?
I would be delighted.
Thank you. Well, Barker, unless he'd ahead. That concludes all the. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3420. As I mentioned earlier, we are rolling over until Monday the work sessions on House Bills 3241 and 2909. And the public, we opened a public hearing, so it would be the work session on House Bill 2327. That concludes our 7 a.m. agenda, so I'm going to adjourn that, the 7 a.m. meeting of the House Judiciary Committee for Friday, April 27th.